For the best sleep, there's nothing better than the Sleepy Bookshelf's premium feed. You'll have ad-free access to the entire catalogue, plus exclusive bonus stories in between our longer books. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more and start your 7-day free trial tonight. Good evening, and welcome to the Sleepy Bookshelf, where we put down our worries from the day and pick up a good book. I'm your host, Elizabeth, and it is lovely to see you again. Tonight we are continuing with Emma. But first, let's take some time to relax. Take a deep breath in through your nose. When you breathe deeply, you physically calm your nervous system, which is why it helps you to feel more peaceful. So as you focus on these calming breaths, pay attention to how the air enters and leaves your body. Maybe how your chest and tummy rise and fall with each breath. If your mind wanders, gently guide it back to this breath. Try not to get frustrated. Inhale deeply, inviting in the positive. And exhale, releasing the negative. Now, bring your attention to my voice as I recap our last episode. Previously, Emma and Harriet had taken a charitable visit to a local poverty-stricken family and were just returning to the lane when they bumped into Mr. Elton. Emma tried to make excuses to lag behind them, to give the two a chance to speak in private. She then deliberately broke the lace on her boot and requested they stop into the vicarage so Mr. Elton's housekeeper could assist her. Emma was disappointed when Mr. Elton did not use this time to declare his love for Harriet, but decided he was simply being cautious. Emma's sister and her family were due to arrive from London, and the preparations took her mind off matchmaking for the time being. Isabella was married to Mr. Knightley's brother, John, and they had 5 children together. They had been away from Surrey for a long while and usually split their time in the county between Hartfield and Mr. Knightley's home at Donwell. Mr. Woodhouse was complaining again of the loss of Miss Taylor, now Mrs. Weston, and Isabella was sympathising with his plight. Emma defended Mrs. Weston, explaining how happy they seemed and how often they had called on Hartfield since the wedding. And that is where we pick up tonight, with Mr. Knightley preparing to join the family at Hartfield for dinner. So just lie back and relax as I turn to the next pages of Emma. Volume 1, Chapter 12. Mr. Knightley was to dine with them, rather against the inclination of Mr. Woodhouse, who did not like that anyone should share with him in Isabella's first day. Emma's sense of right, however, had decided it, and besides the consideration of what was due to each brother, she had particular pleasure from the circumstance of the late disagreement between Mr. Knightley and herself in procuring him the proper invitation. She hoped they might now become friends again. She thought it was time to make up. Making up, indeed, would not do. She certainly had not been in the wrong, and he would never own that he had. Concession must be out of the question, but it was time to appear to forget that they had ever quarrelled, and she hoped it might rather assist the restoration of friendship that when he came into the room, she had one of the children with her, the youngest, a nice little girl about 8 months old, who was now making her first visit to Hartfield, and very happy to be danced about in her aunt's arms. It did assist, for though he began with grave looks and short questions, he was soon led on to talk of them in all the usual way, and to take the child out of her arms with all the unceremoniousness of perfect amity. Emma felt they were friends again, and the conviction giving her at first great satisfaction and then a little sauciness, she could not help saying as he was admiring the baby, "What a comfort it is that we think alike about our nephews and nieces. As to men and women, our opinions are sometimes very different, but with regard to these children, I observe we never disagree."
"If you were as much guided by nature in your estimate of men and women, and as little under the power of fancy and whim in your dealings with them as you are where these children are concerned, we might always think alike."
"To be sure, our discordancies must always arise from my being in the wrong."
"Yes," he said, smiling, "and reason good. I was 16 years old when you were born."
"A material difference then," she replied. "And no doubt you were much my superior in judgment at that period of our lives. But does not the lapse of 21 years bring our understandings a good deal nearer?"
"Yes, a good deal nearer."
"But still not near enough to give me a chance of being right if we think differently."
"I have still the advantage of you by 16 years' experience, and by not being a pretty young woman and a spoiled child. Come, my dear Emma, let us be friends and say no more about it. Tell your aunt, little Emma, that she ought to set you a better example than to be renewing old grievances, and that if she were not wrong before, she is now."
"That's true," she said. "Very true. Little Emma, grow up a better woman than your aunt. Be infinitely cleverer, and not half so conceited. Now, Mr. Knightley, a word or two more, and I have done. As far as good intentions went, we were both right, and I must say that no effects on my side of the argument have yet proved wrong. I only want to know that Mr. Martin is not very, very bitterly disappointed."
"A man cannot be more so,"
was his short, full answer. "Ah, indeed, I am very sorry. Come, shake hands with me."
This had just taken place, and with great cordiality, when John Knightley made his appearance, and "How do you do, George?" and "John, how are you?" succeeded in the true English style, burying under a calmness that seemed all but indifference the real attachment which would have led either of them, if requisite, to do everything for the good of the other. The evening was quiet and conversable, and as Mr. Woodhouse declined cards entirely for the sake of comfortable talk with his dear Isabella, and the little party made two natural divisions, on one side he and his daughter, and on the other the two Mr. Knightleys and their subjects totally distinct, or very rarely mixing, and Emma only occasionally joining in one or the other. The The brothers talked of their own concerns and pursuits, but principally of those of the elder, whose temper was by much the most communicative, and who was always the greater talker. As a magistrate, he had generally some point of the law to consult John about, or at least some curious anecdote to give, and as a farmer, as keeping in hand the home farm at Donwell, he had to tell what every field was to bear next year, and to give all such local information as could not fail of being interesting to a brother whose home it had equally been the longest part of his life, and whose attachments were strong. The plan of a drain, the change of a fence, the felling of a tree, and the destination of every acre for wheat, turnips, or spring corn was entered into with as much equality of interest by John as his cooler manners rendered possible. And if his willing brother ever left him anything to inquire about, his inquiries even approached a tone of eagerness. While they were thus comfortably occupied, Mr. Woodhouse was enjoying a full flow of happy regrets and fearful affection with his daughter.
"My poor, dear Isabella," said he, fondly taking her hand and interrupting for a few moments her busy labours for some one of her five children. "How long it is, how terribly long since you were here, and how tired you must be after your journey. You must go to bed early, my dear, and I recommend a little gruel to you before you go. You and I will have a nice basin of gruel together. My dear Emma, suppose we all have a little gruel."
Emma could not suppose any such thing, knowing as she did that both the Mr. Knightleys were as unpersuadable on that article as herself, and two basins only were ordered. After a little more discourse in praise of gruel, with some wondering at its not being taken every evening by everybody, he proceeded to say with an air of grave reflection,
"It was an awkward business, my dear, your spending the autumn at Southend instead of coming here. I never had much opinion of the sea air."
"Mr. Wingfield most strenuously recommended it, sir, or we should not have gone. He recommended it for all the children, but particularly for the weakness in little Bella's throat, both sea air and bathing."
"Ah, my dear, but Perry had many doubts about the sea doing her any good. And as to myself, I have been long perfectly convinced, though perhaps I have never told you so before, that the sea is very rarely of use to anybody. I'm sure it almost killed me once."
"Come, come," said Emma, feeling this to be an unsafe subject. "I must beg you not to talk of the sea. It makes me envious and miserable, I who have never seen it. Southend is prohibited, if you please. My dear Isabella, I have not heard you make one inquiry about Mr. Perry yet, and he never forgets you."
"Oh, good Mr. Perry. How is he, sir?"
"Why, pretty well. Not quite well. Poor Perry is bilious, and he has not time to take care of himself. He tells me he has not time to take care of himself, which is very sad, but he is always wanted all round the country. I suppose there is not a man in such practice anywhere, but then there is not so clever a man anywhere."
"And Mrs. Perry and the children, how are they? Did the children grow? I have a great regard for Mr. Perry. I hope he will be calling soon. He will be so pleased to see my little ones."
"I hope he will be here tomorrow, for I have a question or two to ask him about myself of some consequence. And my dear, whenever he comes, you had better let him look at little Bella's throat.
Oh, my dear sir, her throat is so much better, and I have hardly any uneasiness about it. Either bathing has been the greatest service to her, or else it is to be attributed to an excellent imbrocation of Mr. Wingfield's, which we have been applying at times ever since August.
It is not very likely, my dear, that bathing should have been of use to her. And if I had known you were wanting an embrocation, I would have spoken to...
You seem to me to have forgotten Mr. and Mrs. Bates, said Emma. I have not heard one inquiry after them. Oh, the good Bateses. I'm quite ashamed of myself. But you mentioned them in most of your letters. I hope they are quite well. Good old Mrs. Bates. I will call upon her tomorrow and take my children. They are always so pleased to see my children. And that excellent Miss Bates. Such thorough, worthy people. How are they, sir?
Why, pretty well, my dear, upon the whole. But poor Mrs. Bates had a bad cold about a month ago.
Oh, how sorry I am. But colds were never so prevalent as they have been this autumn. Mr. Wingfield told me that he has never known them more general or heavy, except when it has been quite an influenza.
That has been a good deal the case, my dear, but not to the degree you mention. Perry says that colds have been very general, but not so heavy as he has often known them in November. Perry does not call it altogether a sickly season.
No, I do not know that Mr. Wingfield considers it very sickly, except...
Oh, my poor dear child. The truth is that in London it is always a sickly season. Nobody is healthy in London. Nobody can be. It is a dreadful thing to have you forced to live there, so far off, and the air so bad.
No, indeed. We are not at all in bad air. Our part of London is very superior to most others. You must not confound us with London in general, my dear sir. The neighbourhood of Brunswick Square is very different from almost all the rest. We are so very airy. I should be unwilling, I own, to live in any other part of the town. There is hardly any other that I could be satisfied to have my children in. But we are so remarkably airy. Mr. Wingfield thinks the vicinity of Brunswick Square decidedly the most favourable as to air.
My dear, it is not like Hartfield. You make the best of it, but after you have been a week at Hartfield, you are all of you different creatures. You do not look like the same. Now I cannot say that I think you are any of you looking well at present.
I'm sorry to hear you say so, sir, but I assure you, excepting those little nervous headaches and palpitations, I'm quite well myself. And if the children were rather pale before they went to bed, it is only because they were a little more tired than usual, from their journey and the happiness of coming. I hope you will think better of their looks tomorrow, for I assure you Mr. Wingfield told me that he did not believe he had ever sent us off altogether in such good case. I trust at least that you do not think Mr. Knightley looking ill.
Turning her eyes with affectionate anxiety towards her husband.
Middling, my dear. I cannot compliment you. I think Mr. John Knightley very far from looking well.
What is the matter, sir? Did you speak to me?
Said Mr. John Knightley, hearing his own name.
I'm sorry to find, my love, that my father does not think you looking well. But I hope it is only from being a little fatigued. I could have wished, however, as you know, that you had seen Mr. Wingfield before you left home.
My dear Isabella, he said hastily, pray do not concern yourself about my looks. Be satisfied with doctoring and coddling yourself and the children, and let me look as I choose.
I did not thoroughly understand what you were telling your brother, said Emma, about your friend Mr. Graham's intending to have a bailiff from Scotland to look after his new estate. What will it answer? Will not the old prejudice be too strong?
And she talked in this way so long and successfully that when forced to give her attention again to her father and sister, she had nothing worse to hear than Isabella's kind inquiry after Jane Fairfax. And Jane Fairfax, though no great favourite with her in general, she was, at that very moment, happy to assist in praising.
That's sweet, amiable Jane Fairfax, said Mrs. John Knightley. It is so long since I have seen her, except now and then for a moment, accidentally in town. What happiness it must be to her good old grandmother and excellent aunt when she comes to visit them. I always regret excessively on dear Emma's account that she cannot be more at Highbury. But now their daughter is married, I suppose Colonel and Mrs. Campbell will not be able to part with her at all. She would be such a delightful companion to Emma.
Mr. Woodhouse agreed to it all, but added,
Our little friend Harriet Smith, however, is just such another pretty kind of young person. You will like Harriet. Emma could not have a better companion than Harriet.
I'm most happy to hear it, but only Jane Fairfax one knows to be so very accomplished and superior, and exactly Emma's age.
This topic was discussed very happily, and others succeeded of similar moment, and passed away with similar harmony. But the evening did not close without a little return of agitation. The gruel came and supplied a great deal to be said, much praise and many comments, undoubting decision of its wholesomeness for every constitution, and pretty severe philippics upon the many houses where it was never met with tolerably. But unfortunately, among the failures which the daughter had to insistence, the most recent, and therefore most prominent, was in her own cook at Southend. A young woman hired for the time, who had never been able to understand what she meant by a basin of nice, smooth gruel, thin, but not too thin. Often she had wished for and ordered it. She had never been able to get anything tolerable. Here was a dangerous opening.
Ah,
said Mr. Woodhouse, shaking his head, fixing his eyes on her with tender concern. The ejaculation in Emma's ear expressed, Ah, there is no end of the sad consequences of your going to Southend. It does not bear talking of. And for a little while she hoped he would not talk of it, and that a silent rumination might suffice to restore him to the relish of his own smooth gruel. After an interval of some minutes, however, he began with,
I shall always be very sorry that you went to the sea this autumn instead of coming here.
But why should you be sorry, sir? I assure you it did the children a great deal of good.
And moreover, if you must go to the sea, it had better not have been to Southend. Southend is an unhealthy place. Perry was surprised to hear you fixed upon Southend.
I know there is such an idea with many people, but indeed it is quite a mistake, sir. We all had our health perfectly well there, never found the least inconvenience from the mud, and Mr. Wingfield says it is entirely a mistake to suppose the place unhealthy. And I'm sure he may be depended on, for he thoroughly understands the nature of the air. And his own brother and family have been there repeatedly.
You should have gone to Cromer, my dear, if you went anywhere. Perry was a week at Cromer once, and he holds it to be the best of all the sea bathing places. A fine open sea, he says, and very pure air. And by what I understand, you might have had lodgings there quite away from the sea, a quarter of a mile off. Very comfortable. You should have consulted Perry.
But, my dear sir, the difference of the journey. Only consider how great it would have been. 100 miles, perhaps, instead of 40.
Oh, my dear, as Perry says, where health is at stake, nothing else should be considered. And if one is to travel, there is not much to choose between 40 miles and 100. Better not move at all. Better stay in London altogether than travel 40 miles to get into a worse air. This is just what Perry said. It seemed to him a very ill-judged measure.
Emma's attempts to stop her father had been vain, and when he had reached such a point as this, she could not wonder at her brother-in-law's breaking out.
Mr. Perry, he said in a voice of very strong displeasure, would do as well to keep his opinion till it is asked for. What does he make it any business of his to wonder at what I do, at my taking my family to one part of the coast or another? I may be allowed, I hope, the use of my judgment as well as Mr. Perry. I want his directions no more than his drugs.
He paused, and growing cooler in a moment, added, with only sarcastic dryness,
if Mr. Perry can tell me how to convey a wife and 5 children a distance of 130 miles with no greater expanse or inconvenience than a distance of 40, I should be as willing to prefer Cromer to Southend as he could himself.
True, true,
said Mr. Knightley, with most ready interposition.
Very true. That's a consideration indeed. But John, as to what I was telling you of my idea of moving the path to Langham, of turning it more to the right than it might not cut through the home meadows, I cannot conceive any difficulty. I should not attempt it if it were by the means of inconvenience to the Highbury people. But if you call to mind exactly the present line of the path, the only way of proving it, however, would be to turn to our maps. I shall see you at the Abbey tomorrow morning, I hope, and then we may look over them, and you shall give me your opinion.
Mr. Woodhouse was rather agitated by such harsh reflections on his friend Perry, to whom he had, in fact, though unconsciously, been attributing many of his own feelings and expressions. But the soothing attentions of his daughters gradually removed the present evil, and the immediate alertness of one brother, and better recollections of the other, prevented any renewal of it. Volume 1, Chapter 13. There could hardly be a happier creature in the world than Mrs. John Knightley in this short visit to Hartfield, going about every morning among her old acquaintance with her 5 children, and talking over what she had done every evening with her father and sister. She had nothing to wish otherwise, but that the days did not pass so swiftly. It was a delightful visit, perfect in being much too short. In general, their evenings were less engaged with friends than their mornings, but one complete dinner engagement, and out of the house too, there was no avoiding, though at Christmas. Mr. Weston would take no denial, they must all dine at Randall's one day. Even Mr. Woodhouse was persuaded to think it a possible thing in preference to a division of the party. How they were all to be conveyed, he would have made a difficulty if he could. But as his son and daughter's carriage and horses were actually at Hartfield, he was not able to make more than a simple question on that head. It hardly amounted to a doubt, nor did it occupy Emma long to convince him that they might, in one of the carriages, find room for Harriet also. Harriet, Mr. Elton, and Mr. Knightley, their own especial set, were the only persons invited to meet them. The hours were to be early, as well as the numbers few. Mr. Woodhouse's habits and inclination being consulted in everything. The evening before this great event, for it was a very great event that Mr. Woodhouse should dine out on the 24th of December, had been spent by Harriet at Hartfield, and she had gone home so much indisposed with a cold that, but for her own earnest wish of being nursed by Mrs. Goddard, Emma could not have allowed her to leave the house. Emma called on her the next day and found her doom already signed with regard to Randall's. She was very feverish and had a bad sore throat. Mrs. Goddard was full of care and affection. Mr. Perry was talked of, and Harriet herself was too ill and low to resist the authority which excluded her from this delightful engagement, though she could not speak of her loss without many tears. Emma sat with her as long as she could to attend her in Mrs. Goddard's unavoidable absences and raise her spirits by representing how much Mr. Elton's would be depressed when he knew her state, and left her at last tolerably comfortable in the sweet dependence of his having a most comfortless visit, and of their all missing her very much. She had not advanced many yards from Mrs. Goddard's door when she was met by Mr. Elton himself, evidently coming towards it, and as they walked on slowly together in conversation about the invalid, of whom he, on the rumour of considerable illness, had been going to inquire, that he might carry some report of her to Hartfield, they were overtaken by Mr. John Knightley, returning from the daily visit to Donwell, with his two eldest boys, whose healthy, glowing faces shewed all the benefit of a country run, and seemed to ensure a quick dispatch of the roast mutton and rice pudding they were hastening home for. They joined company and proceeded together. Emma was just describing the nature of her friend's complaint. "A throat very much inflamed, with a great deal of heat about her, a quick, low pulse, etc." And she was sorry to find from Mrs. Goddard that Harriet was liable to very bad sore throats, and had often alarmed her with them. Mr. Elton looked all alarm on the occasion as he said, "A sore throat? Well, I hope not infectious. I hope not of a putrid, infectious sort. Has Perry seen her? Indeed, you should take care of yourself as well as of your friend. Let me entreat you to run no risks. Why does Perry not see her?" Emma, who was not really at all frightened herself, tranquillized this excess of apprehension by assurances of Mrs. Goddard's experience and care. But as there must still remain a degree of uneasiness which she could not wish to reason away, which she would rather feed and assist than not, she added soon afterwards, as if quite on another subject,
"She's so cold. So very cold, and looks and feels so very much like snow, that if it were to be any other place, or with any other party, I should really try not to go out today and dissuade my father from venturing. But as he has made up his mind and does not seem to feel the cold himself, I do not like to interfere, as I know it would be a great disappointment to Mr. and Mrs. Weston. But upon my word, Mr. Elton, in your case, I should certainly excuse myself. You appear to me a little hoarse already. And when you consider what a demand of voice and what fatigues tomorrow will bring, I think it would be no more than common prudence to stay at home and take care of yourself tonight.
Mr. Elton looked as if he did not very well know what answer to make, which was exactly the case. For though very much gratified by the kind care of such a fair lady, not liking to resist any advice of hers, he had not really the least inclination to give up the visit. But Emma, too eager and busy in her own previous conceptions and views to hear him impartially or see him with clear vision, was very well satisfied with his muttering acknowledgement of its being very cold, certainly very cold, and walked on, rejoicing in having extricated him from Randall's and secured him the power of sending to inquire after Harriet every hour of the evening.
"You do quite right," said she. "We will make your apologies to Mr. and Mrs. Weston."
But hardly has she so spoken when she found her brother was civilly offering a seat in his carriage, if the weather were Mr. Elton's only objection, and Mr. Elton actually accepting the offer with much prompt satisfaction. It was a done thing. Mr. Elton was to go, and never had his broad, handsome face expressed more pleasure than at this moment. Never had his smile been stronger, nor his eyes more exulting than when he next looked at her.
"Well," she said to herself, "this is most strange. After I had got him off so well, to choose to go into company and leave Harriet ill behind. Most strange indeed. But there is, I believe, in many men, especially single men, such an inclination, such a passion for dining out. Dinner engagement is so high in the class of their pleasures, their employments, their dignities, almost their duties, that anything gives way to it. And this must be the case with Mr. Elton. A most valuable, amiable, pleasing young man, undoubtedly, and very much in love with Harriet. But still, he cannot refuse an invitation. He must dine out whenever he is asked. What a strange thing love is. He can see ready wit in Harriet, but he will not dine alone for her."
Soon afterwards, Mr. Elton quitted them, and she could not but do him the justice of feeling that there was a great deal of sentiment in his manner of naming Harriet at parting, in the tone of his voice, while assuring her that he should call at Mrs. Goddard's for news of her fair friend, the last thing before he prepared for the happiness of meeting her again, when he hoped to be able to give a better report, and he sighed and smiled himself off in a way that left the balance of the approbation much in his favour. After a few minutes of entire silence between them, John Knightley began with,
"I never in my life saw a man more intent on being agreeable than Mr. Elton. It is downright labour to him where ladies are concerned. With men he can be rational and unaffected, but when he has ladies to please, every feature works."
"Mr. Elton's manners are not perfect," replied Emma. "But where there is a wish to please, one ought to overlook, and one does overlook a great deal." Where a man does his best with only moderate powers, he will have the advantage over negligent superiority. There is such a perfect good temper and good will in Mr. Elton, as one cannot but value.
Yes, said Mr. John Knightley, presently with some slyness. He seems to have a great deal of goodwill towards you.
Me? She replied with a smile of astonishment. Are you imagining me to be Mr. Elton's object?
Such an imagination has crossed me, I own, Emma. And if it ever occurred to you before, you may as well take it into consideration now.
Mr. Elton in love with me? What an idea.
I do not say it is so, but you will do well to consider whether it is or not, and to regulate your behaviour accordingly. I think your manners to him encouraging. I speak as a friend, Emma. You had better look about you and ascertain what you do, and what you mean to do.
Why, thank you, but I assure you, you are quite mistaken. Mr. Elton and I are very good friends and nothing more.
And she walked on, amusing herself in the consideration of the blunders which often arise from a partial knowledge of circumstances, of the mistakes which people of high pretensions to judgment are forever falling into, and not very well pleased with her brother for imagining her blind and ignorant and in want of counsel. He said no more. Mr. Woodhouse had so completely made up his mind to the visit that in spite of the increasing coldness, he seemed to have no idea of shrinking from it, and set forward at last, most punctually, with his eldest daughter in his own carriage, with less apparent consciousness of the weather than either of the others, too full of the wonder of his own going, and the pleasure it was to afford at Randall's to see that it was cold and too well wrapped up to feel it. The cold, however, was severe, and by the time the second carriage was in motion, a few flakes of snow were finding their way down, and the sky had the appearance of being so overcharged as to want only a milder air to produce a very white world in a very short time. Emma soon saw that her companion was not in the happiest humour. The preparing and going abroad in such weather, with the sacrifice of his children after dinner, were evils, were disagreeables at least, which Mr. John Knightley did not by any means like. He anticipated nothing in the visit that could be at all worth the purchase, and the whole of their drive to the vicarage was spent by him in expressing his discontent. A man, said he, must have a very good opinion of himself when he asks people to leave their own fireside and encounter such a day as this for the sake of coming to see him. He must think himself a most agreeable fellow. I could not do such a thing. It is the greatest absurdity. Actually snowing at this moment. The folly of not allowing people to be comfortable at home, and the folly of people's not staying comfortably at home when they can. If we were obliged to go out to such an evening as this, by any call of duty or business, what a hardship we should deem it. And here we are, probably with rather thinner clothing than usual, setting forward voluntarily, without excuse, in defiance of the voice of nature which tells man, in everything given to his view or his feelings, to stay at home himself and keep all under shelter that he can. Here are we setting forward to spend 5 dull hours in another man's house, with nothing to say or hear that was not said and heard yesterday, and may not be said and heard again tomorrow. Going in dismal weather,
to return, probably in worse. 4 horses and 4 servants taken out for nothing but to convey 5 idle, shivering creatures into colder rooms and worse company than they might have had at home.
Emma did not find herself equal to give the pleased assent, which no doubt he was in the habit of receiving, to emulate the "very true, my love," which must have been usually administered by his travelling companion. But she had resolution enough to refrain from making any answer at all. She could not be complying. She dreaded being quarrelsome. Her heroism reached only into silence. She allowed him to talk and arranged the glasses and wrapped herself up without opening her lips. They arrived, the carriage turned, the step was let down, and Mr. Elton, spruce, black, and smiling, was with them instantly. Emma thought with pleasure of some change of subject. Mr. Elton was all obligation and cheerfulness. He was so very cheerful in his civilities, indeed, that she began to think he must have received a different account of Harriet from what had reached her. She had sent while dressing, and the answer had been, "Much the same, not better." "My report from Mrs. Goddard's," said she presently, "is not so pleasant as I had hoped." "Not better," was my answer. His face lengthened immediately, and his voice was of sentiment as he answered, "Oh no, I'm grieved to find. I was on the point of telling you that when I called at Mrs. Goddard's door, which I did the very last thing before I returned to dress, I was told that Miss Smith was not better. By no means better, rather worse. Very much grieved and concerned, I had flattered myself that she must be better after such a cordial as I knew had been given her in the morning." Emma smiled and answered, "My visit was of use to the nervous part of her complaint, I hope. But not even I can charm away a sore throat. It is a most severe cold indeed. Mr. Perry has been with her, as you probably heard."
"Yes, I imagined. But that is, I did not."
"He has been used to her in these complaints, and I hope tomorrow morning he will bring us both a more comfortable report. But it is impossible not to feel uneasiness. Such a sad loss to our party today."
"Dreadful. Exactly so, indeed. She will be missed every moment."
This was very proper. The sigh which accompanied it was really estimable, but it should have lasted longer. Emma was rather in dismay when only half a minute afterwards he began to speak of other things, and in a voice of the greatest alacrity and enjoyment.
"What an excellent device," said he. "The use of a sheepskin for carriages. How very comfortable they make it. Impossible to feel cold with such precautions. The contrivances of modern days indeed have rendered a gentleman's carriage perfectly complete. One is so fenced and guarded from the weather that not a breath of air can find its way unpermitted. Weather becomes absolutely of no consequence. It is a very cold afternoon, but in this carriage we know nothing of the matter. Ha! Snow's a little icy."
"Yes," said John Knightley, "and I think we shall have a good deal of it."
"Christmas weather," observed Mr. Elton. "Quite seasonable, and extremely fortunate we may think ourselves that it did not begin yesterday and prevent this day's party, which it might very possibly have done, for Mr. Woodhouse would have hardly ventured had there been much snow on the ground. But now it is of no consequence. This is quite the season indeed for friendly meetings. At Christmas, everybody invites their friends about them, and
people think little even of the worst weather.
I was snowed up at a friend's house once for a week. Nothing could be pleasanter. I went for only one night and could not get away till that very day se'nnight.
Mr. John Knightley looked as if he did not comprehend the pleasure, but said only coolly,
"I cannot wish to be snowed up a week at Randall's."
At another time, Emma might have been amused, but she was too much astonished now at Mr. Elton's spirits for other feelings. Harriet seemed quite forgotten in the expectation of a pleasant party.
"We are sure of excellent fires," continued he, "and everything in the greatest comfort. Charming people, Mr. and Mrs. Weston. Mrs. Weston, indeed, is much beyond praise, and he is exactly what one values. So hospitable, and so fond of society. It will be a small party, but where small parties are select, they are perhaps the most agreeable of any. Mr. Weston's dining room does not accommodate more than 10 comfortably, and for my part, I would rather, under such circumstances, fall short by 2 than exceed by 2. I think you will agree with me," turning with a soft air to Emma. "I think I shall certainly have your approbation, though Mr. Knightley, perhaps, from being used to the large parties of London, may not quite enter into our feelings."
"I know nothing of the large parties of London, sir. I never dine with anybody."
"Indeed," in a tone of wonder and pity. "I had no idea that the law had been so great a constraint. Well, sir, the time must come when you will be paid for all this, when you will have little labour and great enjoyment."
"My first enjoyment," replied John Knightley as they passed through the sweep gate, "will be to find myself safe at Hartfield again."